Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf. Once again, talking about the game we all love.
We are. We're here again. Plenty to talk about. Plenty coming up. Plenty has happened. And we've been to a film premiere this week, Nick. A first time ever. We've both been attending one of those.
Exactly. I've got a line for you from the very top. Selfie with David Beckham. Of course, I was hopeless. The most hopeless phone call nation ever. He went, give me this thing. Come here. We're about the same age, but I was like basically a granddad from the 70s. And David actually had some idea how to use them. So it was very on brand for Talking Snooker and for me. You'll be glad to know. But we enjoyed it, didn't we? It was a smashing night out. And we'll talk about that later. But Phil, on the table matters, we have to say. UK Championship, one of those special moments of the season, isn't it? When you're on the eve of the UK, it's all in front of you. It's just like, we just cannot wait. So you must be like anyone else that loves this game, just kind of on tenterhooks, thinking we're just settling down for some magical viewing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big one, one of the big ones. We've had a lot to enjoy so far this season and sort of slowly been building up. You know, the International Championship is a big one in itself, but I haven't got the history of the UK that we know so well. So, yeah, you're right. Plenty to be excited about.
Of course. And we'll look back on what was just, again, another brilliant edition of Judgment Day or days to be precise, and look ahead to all the matches coming up in York. And we'll do so, Phil, won't we, in the company of a special guest who's joined us for this UK preview episode. And we really are delighted to have him with us. He's a fellow journalist who has made a big name for himself in motorsport. Today's guest was an incredibly successful former editor of the F1 Racing magazine, a publication that regularly sold well over a million copies every month on his watch. He later became communications director with the McLaren F1 team and then chief communications officer with Aston Martin, and is still heavily involved in the motorsport world today via his own PR agency, Diagonal Communications. But that's only part of the story. He's also a columnist, novelist, historian, and speaker. And more pertinently for us, he has a deep love of snooker, and we can't wait to hear his words of wisdom here today. Matt Bishop joins us on Talking Snooker. Matt, it's great to see you. How are you?
I'm extremely well, and I'm honoured and chuffed and delighted to be on your show.
We don't hear enough of the word chuffed, do we, Phil? I like that. That's a great way to start. Matt, as we do with so many people that join us, tell us how your love affair with this sport started.
Well, you know, for my sins, I'm 60 years old, so it goes back a long time. And it actually started like this, I think, which is, perhaps I hadn't intended to, but I'm starting off with a slightly personal revelation. So there you go. My mum and dad split up when I was a kid, as so often happens occasionally in families. Anyway, they did. And I stayed with my mum, and my little brother also stayed with my mum, and my dad went on his way. And we probably didn't see that much of him for a little while, but then it was via snooker that I rebuilt my relationship with my father. And we're going back, you know, half a century now, really. And now I'm, you know, still pals with him, and we meet up, and my mother's passed away, but my dad's still around. But we lived in Camden Town, or I lived in Camden Town with my mum, and he lived in Hampstead, not very far. These are all places in North London, for those who don't know London. And in those days, London, as most big cities, were beginning to fill up with snooker clubs, as you know, on the back of the success of Pot Black and the whole snooker loopy revolution of the 80s or late 70s and 80s. And we played at the Delancey Street Club in Camden Town, now long closed, but a great club it was. Great tables, great vibe. And when the Masters was going on, which of course was in London, North London, Wembley then, the players used to come, and you'd see Jimmy White practicing there, or you'd see Ray Reardon practicing there. And that was exciting. Well, my dad and I used to play there. And I mean, neither of us was very good, I will admit that, but I was better than him. I was definitely better than him. I think I once got a 60 break. So, wow. You
bloody
know,
hell.
No, come on, guys.
What do you mean, come on? Phil, this is a man that hasn't seen the Tony Meo trophy.
Yeah, no, that's exceptional stuff. Very impressed.
But I think I was probably about 20 then. So we're talking 40 years ago. I don't think my dad ever got a 30 break, to be fair. So, but he did once break his cue in a frenzy of fury when I had about two flukes in a row. Anyway, it was quite an expensive cue, by the way. Anyway, there we are. Snooker stories. I'm sure people listening to this that will resonate with because it is a beautiful game, but it's also the most frustrating game in the world, isn't it, really? Anyway, we basically rebuilt our father-son relationship on the Green Bays, really, in Camden Town. And we still talk about, we don't play anymore, but we still talk about it. I mean, he's 83, but we still talk about it. We occasionally watch it together. And we occasionally moan about the commentators, or like everybody else. So that was my start off into snooker. And motor racing was always my number one passion, and it's how I've earned my money. But snooker was always a secret, almost as much of a passion. Actually, secretly, just as much, to be fair.
I think that sort of, not that exact story, obviously, but a lot of people have, it's beyond just liking the sport, it's like an emotional connection. A lot of people say, oh, they remember watching it with the grandparents, and I think the game reminds them of people they've lost. You know, I think snooker sort of seems to resonate with people on an emotional level, more so than a lot of other sports, it seems.
Well, it's a sport that you can watch and play. I know that that is the case of many sports. It's not certainly not the case with Formula One, but it absolutely is with snooker. And, you know, I suppose I don't know what your view is about this, but I regret the fact that snooker clubs are comparatively few and far between, certainly in London. I've always lived in London. They may be more numerous in other parts of the country still, but the trouble with London is that real estate is so ludicrously valuable that, you know, I mean, the Camden Snooker Club in Delancey Street is now being made into mega posh flats because it would make more money for the developers that way. But I think it's a shame. And there used to be so many snooker clubs around, and there's now few and far between in London anyway. There are some, but there's few and far between. So I've actually got a John Paris cue, but it's hard to find a place to play with it.
No, I think it's just pretty much that one in King's Cross, isn't it? That it is very nice, but very expensive as well, which goes hand in hand with what you're saying. The ones to stay alive, you know, they've got to charge you sort of 15 quid an hour to get on the table.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly wasn't that price before. Having said that, the Camden Town Delancey Street Club regarded itself as a slight cut above. I mean, there were some dodgy places, weren't there? There were some dives. I remember playing in the snooker club in Kilburn High Road when Kilburn was quite dodgy, And I was playing with my mate there. And again, I'm going back more than 40 years into my teens. And while we were playing, the players on the next table were simply arrested. In walked the police, nicked them, cuffed them, and took them out. Everyone just carried on chalking their cue and, you know, getting their eight breaks as everyone else does.
But Camden wasn't so much like, because in my mind, when you say like an old school school club in Camden Town, I'm imagining that, but that was a bit more refined, was it?
That was their plan. Their plan was that it would become that, yes. And there was good players in there, and they made effort with the tables, which is another thing, which is why you'd suddenly see Ray Reardon appearing there, you know.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, perhaps we'll ask you a bit more about motorsport love later, but just first, it's an audio service, but you were showing me before you came on air that it's a, you know, where you are is a bit of a haven to the sport you love. Loads of books, loads of memorabilia. I mean, your love affair with motorsport, and I guess specifically F1, is profound, isn't it? You've been so heavily involved with it. You put up wonderful memories all the time on Twitter. I mean, you're so ensconced in it. It's just such a huge deal for you, isn't it?
I mean, we call ourselves F1 lifers. I am an F1 lifer. I am doing a life sentence, you know. I am the Charles Bronson of Formula One. There's plenty of us. There's plenty of us. But, absolutely. I fell in love with the sport. I remember the exact moment I was walking into a newsagent and I saw a magazine called Autosport, which, of course, is now well-known and is a, you know, very, very busy and successful website. But I'd never seen this. And no, my mum and dad didn't have any interest in or knowledge of Formula One. You have to remember, in those days, Formula One wasn't on the television. It was like being interested in bowls or croquet. It was not mainstream. Football, cricket, rugby, you know, those sports were mainstream. And snooker became mainstream, of course. But Formula One wasn't. Formula One was weird. And I loved cars because I had, you know, I'm just one of these kids that walked down the street saying Morris Marina, Austin Princess, blah, blah, blah. And annoying my mum by naming them as we walked to the shops when I was a little kid. I mean, I didn't do that when I was older. That would have been rather eccentric. Hello, mother. I'm going to name every single car we pass. Shut up, son. Anyway, I did it when I was six. Anyway, and then I suddenly found, when I was 10, I think 9 or 10, I found Autosport, and I realized that there were such things as racing cars. So you could actually play sport in cars. I didn't know that. Nobody ever told me that. And when I actually then began to read the race reports and look at the pictures of the cars, I thought this must have been invented for me only. Only I could be interested in this. And here we are half a century later. And, you know, I've worked for two Formula One teams. I was one of the founders of W Series, which is a single-seater racing series for female drivers. And I was proud of that. It hasn't thrived, but it was successful for a few years. I've edited magazines on the subject. I've founded and contributed to websites. I still write a weekly column for Motorsport magazine website, and I run my own agency in it. All of it is part of my life sentence in Formula One.
What a way to sum it up. I hope we don't refer to talking snooker one day as a life sentence, Phil. That's
I don't know, it doesn't sound like a bad thing when you love it, to be fair. It didn't sound like a negative.
Yeah, no, true.
But you two are snooker lifers, aren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah, 40 years in my case and counting. Yeah. Yes, he couldn't escape it if I wanted to, which I think isn't that a lyric of an old song almost? But it's very much so. I mean, there are certain you do actually sort of pick up love for sports, don't you? And maybe develop them more. But there are two or three, I think, that are there. For me, I guess it would be football and, yes, snooker. Probably a bit of golf as well, but yeah, football and snooker. And I guess you're probably the same, Phil. You know, they're just so inside. They're not going anywhere forever.
Yeah,
I mean, you have it as some of your earliest memories, don't you? Football, snooker, and cricket really go as long back as I can remember. Bit of rugby as well, which I sort of lost the love for. But yeah, those three. yeah, as I say, some of my earliest memories of watching anything really of those sports, and certainly being interested and caring about something so much is football, definitely from the start. So football's the one I often feel like I would like to escape but can't, whereas snooker I've always sort of carried on genuinely loving.
I think, I agree with you. Obviously, Formula One is how I've earned my money. So it's not just an enthusiasm. It's a job. And as I say, a life sentence, albeit an enjoyable one. And I'm not trying to, jump the wall and make my escape, as you say. I love snooker, as I've said, and we'll be talking about in the next little while. And I'm an Arsenal supporter. I love football and cricket. I think those are my sports, really, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, I saw the Gunners live a couple of weeks ago. They're a pretty good side at the moment. We must move on to snooker then, here, Phil and Matt. How much have we got to talk about? My goodness me. And we'll move on to the games to come at the UK Championship shortly. But first, Judgment Day, Phil, an overall view of it. Again, what drama. It is a great formula for this sport, isn't it? And we're stuck on it good and proper now. And to have it extended, not just at the World Championship, but into this, is brilliant. It was presented so well to us, wasn't it? Rob Walker, David Hendon, Stephen Haworth, what a superb team they were, going from table to table, taking us to all the drama. And it was just, throughout Wednesday and Thursday, thrilling stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant. We've long loved the one at World Championship qualifying, so we knew it wasn't going to fail because it's the same format. But it's been a great couple of days, and like you said, Stephen and David did brilliant work. You're basically commentating on four matches at the same time, and you could hear—I don't know if it was intentional or not—but I enjoyed hearing it. Dave doing the sort of directing as well, telling people to jump to doing which tables, and they're long sessions because a lot of these matches go very edgy and deep. And there's not much gap between the afternoon and evening session. So it was a quick bite to eat for them and straight back to it. So I hope those two have had a good lie down today because they deserve it, because it was just fantastic work from both of them and everyone else who was running that production, and Rob Walker, of course. So much drama. Really enjoyable. And I think this switch to the tiered system qualifying format at the UK has been almost entirely well received, doesn't it?
I think so. And Matt, not all sports can do this. You talk about F1, I can't think of a way that, for example, could really... I mean, they switch from car to car, to be fair. That's a thing they can do. But to have different matches in progress at the same time, we see it so well done with NFL. Some football channels do it, actually. But it means you just can't get bored for a moment because you're seeing important moments flash up all the time.
Yeah, I see that. I mean... I must admit, I'm a purist. I am a snooker purist, and I'm a Formula One purist, and I'm a football purist, and I'm a cricket purist. So my favourite cricket, for instance, is test matches. I know, I understand absolutely that 2020 was a wonderful development. But, for me, it's 5 days and stop for lunch and stop for tea and watch someone grinding out an inning. So going back to snooker, I love watching. Oh, I don't like the shootout, by the way. I must admit, I don't like the shootout. We can come to that if we've got time, but I'm not mad about that. But apart from that, I like the long form matches. I don't mind, getting settling into a long, or obviously with the Worlds, it comes up to best of 35 by the end. But, I don't mind that. I don't mind having a 1 hour frame where you've got, Selby grinding it out. And some people, go and make a cup of tea or do whatever they do, but I'm glued to it. I wouldn't say I'm just as happy to watch Selby grinding it out as watching Lizowski make a sparkling century, but almost. I love it all. So, so yes, I completely get what you say. But I wouldn't get bored anyway. I'm a fan.
No, you're right. It, for those of us who love the game, it's hard to get bored anyway. But I just think that format, it wouldn't work all the time. There are times, of course, you want to settle and focus on one match, and then you get the total nuance of what's happening during, the 3 or 4 hours of drama or whatever it is. But I just like, it's almost like a an adrenaline rush, or as much as you can get from this sport, I guess, when you get those, you know, you just, you know, you're right, it's so well directed, and you're a crucial pot here, a big break here. And when it's coming to the climax as well, I think it's just, yeah, really good. But yeah, no, definitely. We're in the right company on this podcast. We're talking about long form matches, and I'm sure most of the listeners will be nodding in agreement with you there, Matt. But let's take you through the results then from the first of the two judgment days. And well, I saw you said something like player to avoid Claxon, Phil Haig, on Twitter. Well, that's Ding Junhui, who beat Bobby Williams 6-3. And another very strong player to go through, Tetraya Unnu, who beat Ricky Walden 6-3. Walden made two centuries to one in that, but Tetraya won through. Nopon Siankan beat Wu Yiza 6-4. It was Fan Zhengzhi 6, Michael White 5. Really dramatic match that went all the way. Jamie Jones 6, Zach Surti 4. Really good run from Surti there. And he came close to making it. And that really would have been so big for him. Anthony McGill 6, Anthony Hamilton 2. Really strong from McGill, actually. Breaks of 92, 81, 70 and 50 from him. It was Matthew Selt 6, Liu Haosham 3. And then Jamie Clark 6, David Gilbert 5. Well, I watched a fair bit of this, Phil. What a scrap. I mean, one on the black went to about 11 minutes. It was a real old battle. And a bit of chuntering going on towards the end as well. I think there was a bit of a, you know, it was one of those where whoever lost it was going to be horrible. And unfortunately for Dave, it was him.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see that much, actually. But I've seen the frame scores. And I think Clark made one half century, which is a 62. So, you know, it wasn't a vintage performance for him. But it doesn't matter when you get the W. And yeah, I mean, there was all sorts going on. I watched that Ding game and he looked very strong. Tetraya Walden was, you know, that's a great game. And they played to a decider in World Championship qualifying judgment day as well, with Tetraya punching the table, which you don't see much from him. That shows what these judgment days can do to people. Yeah, no, I agree. McGill, he's still using that carbon cue in his glove and he's starting to look pretty good with it. When he started those first tournament or two, not so much. He was scraping through a couple of wins, but yeah, he's looking strong. And yeah, Fan Zhengzhi, I thought, looked good as well. I was he beat Michael White, who was making something of a fashion statement. This will be under your fixtures and fittings label, Nick. But a lovely sort of burnt orange shirt with his black waistcoat, which I don't think we're seeing enough of the sort of colourful stuff of the past. But Michael White bringing it back impressively there.
Burnt orange, my God. I feel like I need to give you a yellow card for that. I mean, that is quite fixture and fittingsy. What is that?
Well, it was being described as red on commentary, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't. But yeah, I mean, it looked good, whatever it was.
I'm sure it did. And well, Matt, let's ask you about some of the, you know, maybe Ding Junhui, who's a player that I'm sure you've enjoyed watching over the years. He is a superstar, isn't he? Hard one to get your head around recently because he's just not winning the stuff that, you know, he should for a guy of his talent. But, you know, when he fires, you know, he's just a joy, isn't he?
You know, you obviously some of the players you've just mentioned, I might have more to say about than others. But Ding, certainly, yes. I mean, if you look at his, you know, his CV, if you look at how many ranking tournaments he's won, he actually did win the UK not very long ago, did he? Comparatively not long ago. But otherwise, he's had a bit of a dry spell, bit of a long dry spell. And for a player of his quality, you just watch it and you shrug and you think, what is going on, mate? What is going on? Because when he's in the balls, he is one of those players, more than many. I mean, Ronnie's like this too, but he's one of these players that makes the game look so incredibly easy. And the reason he makes it look so easy is that he's always in perfect position. So he doesn't have to do much with the white ball, with the cue ball, you know, because if he's around, if the reds are spread and the pink and the black is around and free in available pockets, he's just doing little cannons and nudges and stun run throughs and screws, but he's not moving the white ball, the cue ball, very far, and suddenly he's won the frame. That's what I associate with him, and I love watching that, the economy of planning and execution that he is capable of doing. And yet you can just see him, you know, and his head will go down and you can see him getting beaten by, you know, by somebody who really shouldn't be in the same breath as him in terms of pure skill. I don't mean to name anyone, but
I thought you were going to say room. That was a very famous snooker quote from yesteryear from Stephen Hendry. shouldn't even be in the same room as me.
Well, I could have used that. I could have. but you take my point. I mean, yeah. What do you think's up with Ding Junhui?
He's spoken about, you know, what you described there, because he's become sort of a lot more demonstrative with how he's feeling. I think in his sort of peak, you wouldn't get a lot of emotion out of him, but now it's very clear when he's annoyed. And I think he's just frustrated with himself that he's not hitting the standards that he knows he's capable of on a regular basis. And, you know, lockdown really hurt his game, sort of off the table more than anything, being away from his family for so long. And he didn't quite recover that. He's not far off, but I think he's just become a much more frustrated player, which, yeah, he's seen a lot of other players, but it's seeped into his game rather than being a natural sort of personality trait. But when he's firing, he still looks as good as ever. But it's strange. We spoke about on here, he was sort of 4-1 up in a game earlier this season, and he was sat with his head in his hands, just annoyed with himself about how he was playing. So it's just, yeah, he's battling himself more than anything. But if he can get over that, he's still a young man. He could still achieve great things in the game. But there is also a technical thing, which I won't go into too much because that's not my strong suit. But he's got a little pause in his backswing, in his delivery, that wasn't there before. And a lot of people said that's really harming him. So I'm not sure where that's crept in from. But I think there's two reasons there why he's struggling a bit.
That's interesting. That is interesting. I hadn't noticed that. Do you think that would be deliberate, or he's just allowed that to come into his game without really knowing?
I feel the latter, because it almost looks, it's not yips or, you know, like dartitis or however you describe it in snooker, but it almost looks like he's got a little touch of that, but he does deliver it eventually in the end, so it's not stopping him, but it's almost this bit of hesitancy. So I can't imagine he's meant to do it, but I don't think it's helping him.
No. I suppose there was a year, wasn't there? Was it about 10 years ago when he won 5 ranking tournaments, in one of the few people that's done that? And he just looked so strong and so on it and so kind of compact and together. And I suppose that must give any sports person a spring in their step and a peace of mind. And if you've got peace of mind and a spring in your step, I mean, you can be very dangerous in a positive way. And I suppose he doesn't have that now. So whether it's the yips or the dartitis or whatever you've identified, that he can't be feeling confident as he walks into the arena, whereas he used to. You mentioned another player in that little roundup, which is Thepchaya Unnu. And I know I just criticised the shootout and I said I didn't like it, but I did like watching him win it. Mm-hmm. And do you remember that break? What was it? 130 something in about 12 seconds, or whatever it was. And you know, when you see him doing that, you think, why haven't you won, you know, 10 ranking tournaments? Yeah. Why haven't you? Mm. And that's one of the joys and frustrations of snooker, isn't it? Because you look at these people and you think, you're brilliant. You are as good in doing that as anyone who's ever picked up a cue in the last 100 years, and yet you're patchy. And that's because so much of snooker is played in the mind, not on the table. But what do you think of, do they call him Theppy? I'm told they call him Theppy. Yeah.
Well, he's an absolute delight, isn't he? I mean, he's one of those guys, as you say, when he's flying, you think this is just the most thrilling thing you could watch. And I agree. I mean, you're expressing yourself, you know, beautifully here about some of the eternal fascinations with this sport, because me and Phil say it time and again. We sort of said it in a different level about Tom Ford recently, who, of course, has been coming to the fore in recent weeks. It's like, you know, he's just one of the best you can see in the game. And you think, well, why is he not doing it more regularly? But you're right. And having spoken to players for so many years, many will expressly say the mental side of it is the most important. If that's in place, if you're feeling good, you know. And we've seen it with people like Mark Allen recently, haven't we, with how he's got himself into such a more sort of happy state, you know, privately off the table. It's manifesting itself on the table. I'm not suggesting that Thepchaya and Tom Ford have got unhappiness off the table. There are all kinds of reasons why you might not be as mentally, you know, feeling so good about your game as other times. And so, listen, I know it's a bit simplistic. it's God given as well, isn't it? To some extent. I mean, you can change your mental outlook, but you kind of got the brain and the mind you're given as well, a little bit, isn't it? So some guys are sort of blessed with that ability a bit more to start with, and they're very fortunate. Whereas for others, trying to get into that more positive mindset is harder work, isn't it, Matt, if you get my drift?
I think it is. And there's an interesting thing to add to that, which is that in some sports, the concept of form, are you in form or are you not in form, is kind of respected and understood. Cricket is an example. You can say a certain batter, you're supposed to say now, certain batter is in form. And, you know, and he hit three centuries in a row, and then he hit a sparkling 71 and so on and so forth. But the same player can be out of form and, you know, where you would, and there's a bit of luck sometimes, because where you might have played and missed when you were on 11, and then you go on to make a double century, you might have got the edge and been caught in slip. So, you know, this happens in sport. By the way, in Formula One, people don't allow the concept of form. You're always supposed to be on absolutely tip-top form. And there is no tradition. There's no tradition for allowing for, you know, we've got 22 races this year, and I was on form except at Monaco and Monza. I wasn't on form. That's not allowed. Anyway, but form is a thing. And as you say, you called it God-given or whatever-given, but there is such a thing as form. And we talked about it. It can be confidence and spring in the step and peace of mind, but it can just be, I was seeing, you know, the pockets like goal mouths, and the balls were flying in and I couldn't do anything wrong. Or, you know, everything, you know, I got the odd kick and then, you know, and then there was a fluke against me and I went in off and blah, blah, blah. And suddenly you've got a downward spiral. I mean, another player we could mention in this context, who's a player that I'm, like everybody, I'm sure, would love to see him finally break his duck and win a ranking tournament, is Jack Lizowski, who is, you know, as brilliant on, just like I was talking about Thep Chaya, you know, on form, there is nothing better than watching Jack Lizowski bang in a century. But how has he not won a ranking tournament? I know in recent years he's been, you know, he's been there or thereabouts. He's got in finals, he's got in semis, he's got in quarters. His ranking is in the teens most of the time. So he's there or thereabouts, and he qualifies for the Masters and all the rest of it. When is he ever going to win one? You tell me.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it, Phil?
It is, yeah. I mean, I'm still confident it'll happen. I sort of feel with him, I don't know why, but I think when he does, it's going to be a big one as well, you know, something like next week.
I think that.
Yeah, rather than, you know, getting the Championship League on the board or something. I'd be delighted with that, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, him and Thep Chaya are sort of in the same bracket, aren't they? It seems to be sort of decision-making and shot choices. You know, as you say, the talent is absolutely not in question, but... It's the thought process, I guess. And that's why it's often Thep Chaya, people sort of speak of him as if he's sort of an upcoming player, but he's not far off 40, but it's just the way he plays. It's sort of a man who hasn't accrued much. Yeah, true.
He looks young as well, yeah.
He plays a game of someone who's not accrued much experience, really. I think that's the problem, but he has. So I guess some people just learn quicker than others. I mean, Jack Lizowski always talks about how he's a slow learner. And I sort of think he's being hard on himself, but sometimes that's how his game looks sometimes.
Well, I'm not tipping him for the UK's this year, but if I'm not mistaken, I believe that he's, assuming he and his great friend Judd Trump win their early matches, they're due to meet quite early, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
And usually, I mean, they're mates, but Judd kind of has the upper hand by quite some considerable degree, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. So one would normally expect, and by the way, Judd Trump is on sensational form, as we know. So if Judd wins that, then obviously that's the end of Jack's UK. But if Jack did win that, then I would think that that he has perhaps. But how many times have we said this sentence, by the way? but that he have a chance. Although he would be due to meet Selby if Selby won his matches as well. And you know, nobody's harder to beat than Selby. And I think, you know, Selby's the kind of player that Jack can still crumble and his head can go down because he can be ground into depression, really, and then defeat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Some fascinating thoughts there on the number of players. The thing I say about Ding, of course, impossible to predict. You mentioned Matt is UK win. I think it was in 19. He also reached the final last year. That was out of nothing. Both those. He had no form before and showed no form after. And yet, I also, like you, Phil, I said that before, I think Jack, if he does win one, and I think when he does win one, will kind of, it won't be a Dave Gilbert thing. I think it will be a big one. It's just that feeling I have. Let's move on to the second day's results then on Judgment Day. That was on Thursday, yesterday here in the UK. And it was 1 Sijun, 6 Ken Doherty, 3. 1 ending the hopes of 54-year-old Doherty there. Ben Wollaston, 6 Lucas Kleckers, 1. Thumping win for Wollaston. Joe O'Connor, 6 Stephen Maguire, 3. And that was a real result, Phil, because we were kind of tipping maybe Maguire looking quite good of late. But breaks of 76, 68, 54, 67 and 60 from O'Connor. Mark Joyce, 6 Joe Perry, 4. Notable win there for Mark. Pang Jung Soo, 6 Craig Stedman, 2. Hossein Rafai, 6, Scott Donaldson, 4. Elliot Slesser, 6, David Lilly, 3. Have to talk about one of the most unlikely incidents of David Lilly. Screwing the cue ball back after potting the green, dropping the chalk, and then screwing the cue ball going over that chalk. So it was a foul shot. I mean, that was just head-in-hand stuff. Quite extraordinary. Xiao Yulong beating Ian Burns, 6-5. That's a painful one for Burns there. He was 5-3 up. But Zhao came back to win. But let's ask you, Matt, about that incident. I mean, we've all seen everything, but the chalk dropping, okay, that's fair enough. The ball to go over it, oh, no, horrible.
I saw it. Actually, it was a good shot, wasn't it? He screwed back perfectly. So he judged it perfectly. But, you know, I've watched it a few times just because the first time you think, what's gone on? Mm. And then the second time you watch it and you think the chalk's not on the table. It's not like he's left it there, but just at that moment, it just pops out of his waistcoat pocket onto the baize and the white ball grazes it. Presumably, obviously, if the white ball hadn't hit it, it wouldn't have been a foul. Mm. It was just the fact that there was a collision. And you just look at it and you think that, you know, there's a famous phrase, isn't there? What are the odds of that happening? And, you know, or even where's the cue ball going as a certain commentator would have said. But anyway, it was an extraordinary moment. And that is snooker. You know, that is a very, very, very odd freak thing to happen. But that's the point. You know, you can so easily go in off, and then if you didn't go off, it rattled in the jaws, you might have made a one-visit frame winning break. Do you see what I'm saying?
It's a bit like cricket, isn't it? I'm thinking of when the ball hits the helmet behind them. Isn't that 5 runs? I thought you always used to be. It's like it's almost as mad as that, Phil Hague, isn't it?
Yeah, lovely little quirks to the game, aren't they? Yeah. And I'd never seen that before. And his reaction was, I mean, I felt for him, but it was very funny at the same time.
I'll tell you what, he's not going to keep the chalk in that pocket again.
True.
Going
forward. Yeah.
Well, Stephen Hallworth found it very funny, didn't he, Phil? He was absolutely loving it in commentary. And I think, yeah, Dave made a point about that. I'm sure everyone would be the same to you. But it was funny, wasn't it? You know, but in terms of those matches, I mean, you know, it was lots to sort of think about there. And, you know, but yeah, I say the last one's really painful. Ian Burns is looking so good there. But Zhao sort of finished really strongly and didn't do an awful lot wrong. But that feels like that'll be such a sore one for him.
It will, because you know, Burns doesn't win a whole lot of games on tour, really, and he suddenly burst into life in this tournament. 6-0 in the first round against amateur Amanit. Well, fair enough, he was favourite to win that. Then 6-0 against Liam Highfield with an upset, and then 6-2 against Jack Jones. You know, he won 3 games and only dropped 2 frames, and then he was looking good to beat Zhao Yulong as well. So it was really sort of his best run for ages, and it could have been, yeah, really dreamy to get to the Barbican. But, you know, Zhao Yulong is a really, really good player. He's been in that category of best players not to win a tournament for a little while now. He's on the fringe of the top 16. He's still only very young himself. He's been around a little while now because he and Yanbingtao won the World Cup when they were still at school. So he's still going to develop into one of the best players in the world. So, yeah, no shame in losing, but a tough one. But, yeah, you were right in picking out Joe O'Connor against Maguire. I thought that was a fantastic result for Joe. Maguire's been in good form, and Joe's not really. He's not done a lot this season so far. He'd scraped through against Ollie Lyne 6-5, which is a good win in itself. But to beat Maguire, yeah, really good effort. And and set up an interesting match in York against John Higgins, who he's beaten twice before, so he won't be scared. And yeah, that's good to see from Joe, because I really rate him as a player, actually. He got to his first final last season, and as I said, hadn't kicked on so much so far this campaign, but yeah, encouraging stuff there. And like a few people, I imagine, because it was the only one still going on the afternoon session on Thursday, I watched the end of Mark Joyce against Joe Perry, where Joe Perry was hunting down snookers for so long there to go off the air and just leave it. And I'd say, you'll have to find out later if he managed to get them. And he didn't get them, unfortunately, for Joe. But it was a fantastic effort. And like you said earlier, Matt, you know, it's not all knocking in centuries. I was loving watching that for as long as it lasted.
He's got Selby, isn't he? That's good preparation there.
Yeah.
Ideal preparation. But yeah, that's all part of the game, isn't it? And you're right, not just about the big breaks. We love those moments as well. And there was so much to enjoy in Judgment Day. And we're now going to move on, of course, because the big stage is upon us. The Barbican Centre in York. What a fabulous 9 days to come. And you are listening here to Talking Snooker with Phil Haig and Nick Metcalf and our special guest, Matt Bishop.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
And let's move on then to the UK Championship and smashing week to come. We can't wait for it all. Not a bad way to kick off, Phil. Not bad. Mark Allen, Ding Junhui. Repeat of the final. Rob Walker. What a classic Rob. I can't believe it. But did you see the way he sort of claimed that it was Ivan Hercevich showing some rare emotion? I was just literally just sitting there writing something down. I mean, it was...
He probably got a smile out of him, and that was headline news.
just sitting there quietly writing. And anyway, so it's a repeat of last year. But to be fair, there has been a win for Ding since then in a really big event, the Tour Championship. But that was a painful one last year. And for the Saturday afternoon crowd, and those of us watching on television, absolute cracker.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, what a way to start. Yeah, that final, Ding was 6-1 up, I think, if my memory serves. So, and yeah, I remember... After that afternoon session, which finished 6-2 then, I remember Ronnie O'Sullivan being on punditry duty for Eurosport and just really slating Allen's performance, saying he couldn't remember anyone playing so badly on the big stage, which, you know, he had played poorly, but then obviously he turned it around in spectacular style in the evening. I don't remember Ding sort of crumbling. Allen just powered up, as it were. So, what a start. Allen in fine form after the Champion of Champions. Ding looking good, so... Alan's going to be favourite, I imagine, but you know, you're not going to be surprised whichever way that one goes.
I think it's an interesting match, or for 100 reasons, but one reason is that in a sense, you know, their kind of temperamental snooker journey over the past few years has gone almost in opposite directions.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
One was both fine players, obviously both fine players, goes without saying, top players, but you know, Mark Allen's lost 4 stone, you know, whatever that is in kilograms, in new money. It's a lot of weight. He's sometimes changed his style of play. You know, there have been a couple of I think at tournaments that there was one that he attracted a lot of negative publicity for turning himself temporarily into Cliff Thorburn. But he did well. He did well. He won it, I think, didn't he? And he has won a lot lately. And now he walks out into the arena with confidence, expecting to win, which perhaps he didn't do when he was, a chubby guy waddling around the table, not always winning. And now Ding Junhui, sorry if you're listening, Mark, to call you a chubby guy waddling around. But anyway, there you go. Anyway, you're very fit and thin now. It's all good. But Ding, the other way around, no weight change, but hasn't got the spring in the step anymore. And it's an interesting, it's not that long ago you'd have looked at that and said Ding's a favourite. Now you say Alan's a favourite by easy.
Yeah, interesting thoughts there. Mark Williams against Fang Zhengzhi then. Mark's won their two previous meetings, but obviously Fan's just had a top win over Michael White in qualifying. I mean, you're saying you express yourself beautifully. I can imagine you will about Mark Williams, Matt. He is some extraordinary player to watch, isn't he? I mean, the way he floats the balls in, he's just a dream. And, he's already won the tournament this season. So, he likes a big stage. We know that. So you wouldn't bet against him having a run, although this isn't the most comfortable of starts for him.
Isn't it interesting? You use the verb there, that he floats the ball in. That's become a Mark Williams verb, hasn't it? That's his verb. That's how he gets the balls in the pockets. He floats them in. And by the way, there are other words that apply to other players. If a commentator says, "Now let's have a look at that Rolls-Royce cue action," it's Sean Murphy. There are other people who've got great cue actions, but somehow Sean Murphy's got the Rolls-Royce. Anyway, going back to Mark Williams, he is an extraordinary player, and he's obviously the CV, the success, the longevity, all of those things are stunning. But there's also this kind of rather, this swagger, this I don't practice very hard and I don't care if I win or lose, but by the way, I do win quite a lot. And, playing snooker escapes underarm with one hand and, entertaining, unusual, floating pots. And, I don't know Fang Zhengzhi very well, but big job for him to beat Mark Williams, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a bit of a shame on that Saturday afternoon. It's on the same time as Alan and Ding, because we'll all be watching that one, I think. But it's always a shame to be missing any Mark Williams match, because he's usually very near the top of my list for players to watch. And there was a remarkable tease from Alan McManus at the last tournament, the Champion of Champions, when he revealed that Mark Williams has invented a new shot that he'd showed him on the practice table and McManus was blown away by. And we never got to see it at the Champion of Champions, and I still don't know what it is. And I'm fascinated to know, because I can't even imagine what it could be. But if we see it next week in York, that's something to look forward to.
I bet we do. Well, I don't obviously know what it is. I haven't got a clue. But knowing that kind of nonchalant swagger of Mark Williams, he'll get in the final and he'll reveal it in the deciding frame.
That is exactly the sort of thing he would do. Found the tournament winner, of course. So he's no stranger to delivering unlikely results. But obviously you fancy Mark in that one. But I tell you who does look vulnerable, Kyron Wilson. Phil, I mean, against Jamie Clark, maybe no quarter given in that one. That could be a real old scrap, a real old battle, actually. Kyron has won both their previous meetings, but Jamie Clark, of course, match sharp after beating David Gilbert in that deciding frame we talked about. Kyron not with the best of seasons so far. He may come good, of course, but he might find that one tough, eh?
Yeah, Clark's a bit of an unpredictable player, as most are, really. He's had a great run through there, beating Jordan Brown and David Gilbert. They're two really good wings. And Kyron had a bad season by his standards, by a lot of people's standards, really. It's been very disappointing. Clearly Kyron's still the favourite, but you wouldn't be too surprised either way there. I mean, I don't want to say that after every draw, but I had a look at last year and it was 7 out of the 16 qualifiers did win. So we are looking at good chances for these guys in qualifying. But Kyron has been good in the UK in recent years. He fell a bit early last year, but semi-final before that, a couple of quarters. But yeah, he's not going to be sharp because he's actually barely won a match since he quarterfinals in Germany in the European back in August. That's going to feel like a long time ago because he really hasn't won many matches at all since then. So it could be a sticky one for him.
And we talk about, of course, things that are hard to avoid saying. I think of it more the crucible, but it's also the same here. It's really hard to avoid saying that the other guys are match sharp. In fact, it might come more into its own in Sheffield because the players haven't played so much before then, whereas now the tournaments are coming a bit more thick and fast. It's probably not quite as relevant as it is for Sheffield. But it's no doubt that if you played in those qualifiers, you know, you're going into it feeling with like a, you know, real confidence. And, you know, that probably be the case for Nopon Sankham against Tom Ford then, which is a match coming up on Saturday night. We talked about Tom Ford already on here, Matt. I mean, he's got so much incentive now just into the top 16. Can he try and stay there for the Masters? I mean, it would be some effort, wouldn't it, for a guy at that age to play at the Masters?
I think he's an example of something I sometimes say. You know, you look at the top 16 and you think, the top 16 should have 32 players in it, really, because there's 32 players that should be in the top 16. And you know, I know he is now. He is, isn't he? He's just made it. But he hasn't always been there. But then you look at other players that are outside the top 16 and you think, well, he certainly should be in the top 16, you know. So I see that. It's an absolute example of the strength in depth that there is now in snooker, and that, which means that, you know, you mentioned just now, you mentioned Kyron Wilson, what's he, number 8 or something like that? Yeah. And you know, Jamie Clark is ranked much lower, and yet you wouldn't be sure that Kyron Wilson's going to win that match at all. And I think Tom Ford has just grinded his way up there. He's a fine player, obviously, and he's been around a long time. How old is he, in fact?
40.
I think he's just got his 40s, yeah, 40.
There you are. Having said that, that means he's only just a bit older than Thep Chairon Nu, by the way.
Yeah.
even though he looks like he is quite a bit older. Anyway, never mind. But, I think that's an example of the kind of person, the kind of player that can find their way back in. You know, Anthony Hamilton's another one, a fine player. Ranking isn't great, but you know that when he's on form, his break building is sensational. He won the German Masters, didn't he, a few years ago? And I was so chuffed. Sorry, I've used that word again. I was so chuffed for him to win it. You know. Anyway, yeah, Tom Ford, same kind of, not the same kind of person or player in some ways as Anthony Hamilton, but the same thing. You know, a player who's been around a long, long time, who's a very good player, and is one of the players who should always have been in the top 16, even though there isn't room for the 32 players that should be there.
Yeah, exactly. I actually spoke to Tom yesterday, day before, but there'll be an interview coming out either later tonight or Saturday morning, and interesting to speak to, actually. He's a glass half empty character, I think it's fair to say, because I started the interview by saying, congratulations on the top 16, and he immediately went, well, yeah, for now.
I wasn't sure you were going to reveal that. I thought you might. No, that's lovely. You texted me straight away, didn't you? I like that.
But yeah, he's a funny guy. But yeah, it's certainly he struggles to look on the brighter side of things, I think, is a fair way of saying it.
Well, we can all get in patches like that. Sunday, Luca Bissell won Sojourn. I'm interested to hear what you think about Luca generally, Matt, in the context of first-time Crucible winners, which we've seen struggle. I wouldn't quite say Luca's, I wouldn't go far struggling. He's just having quite a moribundish season, really. But there's a unique pressure, isn't there, when you've won that tournament for the first time, especially at his age, relatively young compared to maybe some other winners of late, you know, to deliver the next season when you've hit those heights. It's human nature. I think we're seeing that from him, aren't we, so far? He's had a couple of good runs, but generally he's finding life quite hard work as a first-time world champion.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget, of course, he wasn't favourite to win the World Championship by any means when he did win it, and but he's got a wonderful touch player when he's in form, but you know, again, there's another chubby man who's I don't practice, By the way, are they? Do you think it's bravado, this I don't practice business, or do you think it's true?
I think it's slightly exaggerated. That's my answer for you.
Yeah, there you go. So anyway, but he has said that from time to time, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And yeah, he won the World Championship, and it was a you know, he won, his form in that final was stupendous. And although he had his moments of fear, but it was stupendous. And overall, and now, yes, he's had a lean time. But, you know, he could still, as a touch player, I think he could still bounce back. He you know, he should win his first match in the UK, one would hope. And, you know, it depends who he meets and it depends what happens afterwards. But he reminds me, actually, of a Formula One driver. He reminds me of Kevin Magnussen. Both brilliantly talented, and they actually sound alike, which is odd when Luca is Belgian and Kevin is Danish. But when they speak English, for some reason, the accent comes out quite similar. You know, put them in YouTube, you'll see what I'm on about. Okay. Anyway, but they're both very, very talented. You sometimes feel that maybe, you know, they enjoy a few night outs with their mates a little bit more than perhaps some of the more dedicated others, if you see what I mean. And that is the nature of sport. Sometimes you have to knuckle down and knuckle down some more and knuckle down some more after that. And maybe Luca hasn't always done that. We'll see what happens. How old is he now? Still in his 20s, isn't he?
Late 20s, 28, 29 now?
Yeah, 28, yeah.
Yeah.
So he could play for another 10 years. And you know, is he going to be someone who wins, you know, two or three tournaments? Or is he suddenly going to dial into a, you know, a Judd Trump style, you know, Juddernaut, or a Neil Robertson style Robinaut, or whatever you want might call it.
Oh God, you're christening snooker phrases for us here, Matt. This is priceless stuff. A Robinaut, if he goes on a winning run. I spoke to Neil Robertson in recent days, and he's saying there's nothing wrong with his game. By the way, he's pulling it down to a number of disappointments and mishaps, and you can see that story on Sporting Life. Neil's still talking a good game, and he's saying, you know, he's got a big trip to Australia and he expects to come back from that refresh. But he's also saying no reason why he can't win this. He's saying he's flying in practice. So that was a nice little mention there, just while I remember to say it. Yeah, so obviously, Luca favourite. They played one match nearly a decade ago, which Luca won, so not really relevant. One had one good run this season to the quarterfinals of the Northern Ireland Open, but obviously you make Luca favourite. Phil, Zhang-Ander Elliott Slesser on Sunday afternoon. Zhang beat Slesser 4-1 at the recent English Open, and he's having a marvellous season. But obviously, you know, Slesser will go in with confidence with that win over David Lilly. But yeah, we just keep saying that, you know, what we've been saying for a few weeks now, Zhang, just a revelation of recent weeks and months.
Yeah, 100%. One of the stars of the season. You know, Judd Trump is very hard to topple from that position so far, but Zhang's not far behind him. And like I mentioned earlier, the International Championship, it won't get the sort of kudos because it's not one of the traditional ones. But in terms of the format and everything about it, prize money's not far off. It's not too far off the UK Championship. And Zhang won that very impressively. So there's no reason why he can't challenge. And yeah, if he gets past Slesser and Luca Brasel won his first game, then they would meet in the second round, which I'd be fascinated to see, you know, a player that, as you said, I wouldn't go as far as struggling, but hasn't done anything yet this season, other than that run in Shanghai, which is very good, against one who is flying in Zhang. So that would be very interesting. Slesser is a real tough cookie, very dogged and determined, very good on his day. He doesn't show it often as he could do, but yeah, Zhang's in such good form and you can't really back against him. Even in that defeat to Ding at the Champions, he produced some great stuff. So really looking forward to seeing him again, just how long he can ride this wave for. We won't know until it stops how much it's just a purple patch or he's at a new level where he's going to stay. But yeah, looking forward to seeing if it can last through the week in York as well.
Yeah, well, you mentioned his possible second round clash there, which would be fascinating, if presuming they both get through their first round matches. And I mentioned a little while ago the possible clash in the second round between Judd Trump and Jack Lizowski, which is going to be galvanizing, compelling TV for sure. But there are, of course, you can never say, because you don't know that the player you have in mind is going to win his first round match. But assuming some of them or all of them do, there are some very, very tasty second round matches, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. When you get down to 32 players, then it gets spicy very quickly. I mean, there's some great first round matches, but yeah, if the favourites come through, then yeah, it gets very interesting immediately.
And that's what they changed the format for, isn't it? Let's be clear that we have that. Can I say gravitas, Phil? I don't use that word very often, as you know, but occasionally I like to chuck it in. I'll tell you what session I'm looking forward to. I mean, loads of them. But Sunday night, I'm actually going to be on a train back from Merseyside to London. And I'll tell you what, I hope the old Wi-Fi is behaving itself, because Sean Murphy, Hossein Rafai and Ali Carter, Matthew Sell. I love the contrast in those two matches, actually. And with Sean as... We know won the tournament this season, but have been a bit up and down since. Hossein, you know, always capable of a run. He reached the semi-finals at the British Open. And then, of course, the other side could be very intense, is the word I've written down here, between Carter and Sell. Ali having a pretty good season, one final, one quarterfinal. And, the thing that came to my mind about Sell was, of course, he beat Judd Trump, didn't he, at this event memorably 2 years ago. So... always capable of sort of toppling, you know, the biggest talents in the game type thing. But yeah, that's one for me. I've got it in my diary, Phil. Sunday night, contrasted matches, proper UK championship snooker.
Yeah, for sure. I think intense is the right word. I think they're quite good mates, Carter and Selt. So I don't know if they'll take slightly the edge of sort of manic intensity off it or not. I doubt it. They're both two fiery characters. But yeah, it'd be hard to... not be watching Murphy Rafai, though, because that is a very attractive contest. A very interesting one. Like you say, Murphy struggling for results, but I'm not sure he's been struggling for performances as much as he has for results. People have just been playing really well against him. So, yeah, and obviously he's got a great record in the UK, but Rafai's picked up some great wins in the UK as well. Hasn't he beat Selby the last 2 years?
Oh, yeah.
So he could definitely do it. So,
I've gotten that.
Yeah, that is one to look forward to, for sure.
And don't forget, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I believe that Sean Murphy has a Rolls-Royce Q action. Did you know?
Quick one from you, Matt. If Ali Carter's supposedly Marmite, where do you stand? Fan or no fan?
I'm not massively pro Ali Carter. Intense is the word. Intense is, look, he's a fine player, but he's not for me very entertaining to watch. And he's very intense. You always think he's about to beat someone up. And I don't mean I believe he is going to. I just mean he has that intense, smouldering look on his face. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. He wants to win, desperately wants to win. I'm allowed to say that I don't agree with his politics?
Of course you are.
I just did.
Of course you are. You're allowed to say most things on Talking Snooker. No swearing, of course. Unless Rob Walker joins us, Phil, and then they're swearing about every 5 minutes. But if Rob's not on here, no swearing. Now, Monday, Judd Trump, Hang Jung Soo. Judd, the clear player of the season. Three tournament wins plus two finals. But Hang had a couple of good wins. I was just checking his results over Fang Zhengjing and Mark Davis at the International Championship recently. He's gone a hide into nothing against Judd, let's be clear. Perhaps I should ask you about that, Phil. Obviously, Judd, a big favourite and generally expected to go well at this tournament. The dip will come, because it always does. He'll hope it won't come yet.
Yeah, of course. Pang is a very impressive player. He sort of he's made his way up the rankings without much fuss. And it takes a lot of fuss. You know, just stayed on tour when you break onto the tour, it's very difficult. He's up to 34, which is just great effort from him at 23 years old. Not that spectacular, maybe, but he gets results. But yeah, he's got probably the hardest draw possible against Judd first up. Judd, it's one of those where we put the narrative on retrospectively, really. But I think potentially losing that final to Mark Allen like he did in Bolton is not a terrible thing for his UK championship chances.
Yeah, I agree with that.
He'll have gone away and concentrated on his game, and a little bit of a, not that he needed a kick up the backside, but it never hurts to have one ahead of a big tournament. So, I think Judd will win this. But Pang, yeah, is a very capable player. Pushed Ronnie at the Crucible on his debut there this year. So it's not going to be a walkover by any stretch, but yeah, I fancy Judd.
I'm going to use a word about Judd. I'm going to use the word genius. I think he is a genius. And by that, I mean, what do I mean by genius in this context? What I mean is some of his shots, it's not just the execution, which is sometimes faultless, but it's also the imagination to see what is possible. And then the genius is to deliver the execution to make that seemingly impossible shot possible. We saw one recently, didn't we? A green off its spot where he played with a bit of top and right-hand side, took the cue ball off two cushions and nudged a red into a potable position over the right middle. I'm sure you remember the shot. Mm. I watched it about 100 times, and every time I thought, how can he squeeze it through the balk colours in that way? Is it really entirely intentional? But it was a deliberate, every move of every single angle and inch that cue ball went was planned, and you know, how many other players could play that shot? You tell me.
Well, not many. His shot making is quite extraordinary, no question. And he's been playing, you know, not just winning tournaments, but playing a number of them this season. That's why he is such a special character in the game, I think, because he has that, you know, intense ability to focus and knuckle down and win stuff and also play brilliant shots along the way. So he has the sort of perfect package, if you like, as a player.
And see the brilliant shot as well. And have the, you know, that was in tournament play. It wasn't like the opponent needed snookers. That was, you know, serious. Yeah. I need to win this frame. And yet he took on a shot like that, envisaged it, and delivered it perfectly. And that's why I use the G word. I think that constitutes snooker genius.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Barry Hawkins, Ben Wollaston, well, they've met at the last two Welsh Opens with one win apiece. Wollaston with plenty of tournament runs over the year, but not so much recently. And Hawkins, we've been saying it time and time again on here, Phil, so consistent this season, loads of deep runs. And, of course, a tournament win at the European Masters under his belt. We'll probably go under the radar, because he always does. And we'll quite possibly have a long run, because he nearly always does. Monday, 7 p.m, Mark Selby, Mark Joyce. Well, Selby's won all their five previous meetings. He's twice a UK winner, once a runner-up, two other semis. Great to record in this tournament. Joyce has been to two UK quarterfinals, actually, but going back, you know, a fair few years now. And as we said earlier, he has just met Joe Perry, which will be some preparation for Selby. But Matt, can you ever have any real preparation for Mark Selby in this sport? I'm interested to see, you're a man of words. There's always some kind of metaphor linked to Selby. What's your metaphor for Mark Selby?
Granite. The word is granite, isn't it? I'll tell you what I admire about Mark Selby. A lot of things. Obviously, you know, fantastic record. Great guts. He's also had his demons off the table, which he's conquered, and you know, massive kudos to him for that, and the bravery to be honest about it. But what I see in Selby is a player that, you know, if he's not in good nick, you know, and you suddenly you look at it and you think his best break in this session was 31. The other guy's got two centuries, but they're four all. And how did that happen? How did that happen? It happened because he grinds it out and he knows who he's playing. Of course, you play the table, but he plays the player too. He always, you know, finds a way to tuck up and frustrate the player, which is why I think, assuming he wins his match, and if Lisowski is lucky enough to beat Trump, then that's going to be a big problem for Lisowski coming up against Selby. He's not unbeatable, of course, but he's about the best player at winning when he's playing badly, I suppose I would say.
Great way of saying it. It's so true, isn't it, Phil? We said it. I mean, Higgins is the other one that comes to mind. And actually, Ronnie a little bit, because that part of Ronnie is underrated. But Higgins, perhaps the ultimate, but Selby very close in crucible terms. I've seen Higgins be awful by his standards. Wait a sec, it's four each. How's he done that? Yeah, they're masters, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And that's what people say. That's what other players are jealous of. We always talk about B and C and D games. You know, Selby can win without playing anything like his best. And we all know no one can play the best all the time. In fact, you can't even play it half the time sometimes. So if you're capable of as you say, in these long format matches, going sessions and not losing them without finding your best, you know, and then you're always aware that it's somewhere lurking to be dug out, and you're in a very strong position. I was looking at his record, actually. Players like Mark Selby, there's a few that you could speak about like this. I have such a long history in the UK that you sort of think of them as having good records.
Not lately.
No, yeah. No. Higgins is the same. Sort of, they've come and gone. You know, Selby had a 5-year spell where he won it twice, was in the final and semi-final, but then the 6 years since that, he's been to one quarter-final, and that's the best he's done. So yeah. It's hard to say whether he's got a good record in the UK or not. Won it twice, so that's got to be good, but not recently.
And it's really weird because that shows the vagaries of when you're informed, because during that 6-7 years, he's been brilliant in Sheffield for a lot of it. And let's be clear, he'd rather be good in the spring than he would in the early part of the winter. He'd rather be good at both times. But you know what I mean? That's not always possible. So I find it interesting that his world record's been so much better than his UK at that in that time type thing. Let's move on then to Jack Lazowski, Jamie Jones. We mentioned Jack a fair bit. I always think it's maybe unfair, but maybe, you know, his record means there is a fairness to thinking he's often the one to look relatively vulnerable in tournament draws. I mean, Jones has won there too. Previous meetings, but a long time ago. Jack, obviously, favourite, but you know, I wonder if this will be the week when he has a really big run. As Matt's been saying, he's certainly got some tough hurdles to come, even if he wins that one. And then Ronnie O'Sullivan, Anthony McGill, Tuesday afternoon. Well, this match will always bring back memories of their Crucible meeting, of course, from 2021. But Ronnie did win 6-2 when they met at the International a few weeks ago. My Sporting Life colleague, Richard Mann, actually, and Neil Folds are both talking up big runs for Ronnie, and it sort of feels like it might be time, Phil. Listen, we haven't got crystal balls, but if we talk about people that love this tournament, Ronnie's right up there.
Yeah, for sure. He's due a run in a ranking event. It's the World Championship last year, his last one. You know, not a bad last one to have on his CV, but yeah, he's not been doing it in ranking events. And yeah, it's an interesting one. You think McGill, and that's the match that springs to mind. So you think, oh, McGill does well against O'Sullivan. The record is not that like that. That's his only win against it. But again, just what a win to have on your CV. But yeah, he's just vulnerable at the minute, isn't he? And McGill's going to be sharp. As you said, he played very well in qualifying. It's not out of the question that Anthony will win that game. But I think O'Sullivan will be dialed in. It was so strange last year when he looked really good. He looked like he was dialed in and looked like he may well win it again, and then got walloped 6-0. So you never know quite what to expect from him in ranking tournaments at the minute. But yeah, I very much respect the opinion of the men you just mentioned there. And if they're fancying a deep run, I'm not going to argue with them too much.
What do you think, Matt?
Well, you know, it's a best of 11, isn't it, at that stage of the tournament? So up to 6. I'm going to say something. I could say he could win 6-0 or lose 6-0. And he probably neither of those results will happen. But there isn't a single match that Ronnie O'Sullivan starts that you don't think that he could, to use your word, wallop the other player or sink into a gurning mess. You know, when he's... You know, he sits in the, you know, misses and he pulls his face this way and he pulls his face the other way. And you think, what are your demons? I mean, we might talk about the movie that we've all seen. He could win the whole tournament at a canter with a ton of centuries, or he could go out and say, well, don't care if I win or lose, really. And then it'll be on Eurosport.
Well, that wasn't a bad impression at all.
Not bad.
Listen, I'm wary. We've all got Friday nights out, haven't we? So a bit of a race against the clock. But listen, let's go on to John Higgins, Joe O'Connor. O'Connor's beaten Higgins a couple of times in previous meetings. Higgins will be wary because I've seen O'Connor knock out his good friend Maguire, of course. John not having a bad season. He's either look at the 1 year list and he's 11th. So that's obviously a guide to he's doing okay. He's reaching semis, but I guess he's so amazing, John, that you sort of think, well, he's not getting to finals. He's not having a good season. He is having a good season. He'd obviously be favourite in that one, but by no means anything like a foregone conclusion. Tuesday night, Neil Robertson, Zhao Yilong. I mentioned my interview with Neil coming up. He's talking a good game, but you know, there's no good results to back that up at the moment, frankly. I noticed actually their past results that Robertson beat Zhao in that epic run He beat him in the semis when he won that famous tournament in COVID when he beat Judd Trump in the final. And well, Zhao had a good run to the quarterfinals of the English this season, beating Ali Carter on the way. I'd like to think that Neil will have a run, Bill, because they keep us talking about that long run of calendar year victories. But as I say, the evidence isn't saying so. So we'll learn a lot on that day, won't we?
We will. And this is his last chance, as far as I'm aware,
to
keep that alive. I mean, that'd be some way to do it. Well, I mean, that would be amazing. Befitting of a man of his stature. But yeah, it would take a remarkable turnaround in form because it just hasn't been there at all. And a tricky game against Zhou Yulong as well. So we'll see. Yeah. I mean, Higgins, I mentioned that sort of same thing as Selby, seemingly having a good record. So Higgins started in the UK by his first six visits to the UK. He won two, one final, two semis. So you'd think, oh, he's made for this tournament. But then since he won it in 2010, and since then he's not been past the quarter final. He's only been to three quarters. So that's an incredible record, really. That's so shocking for a man of his quality. So he doesn't have a great time of it in York. He lost in the first round last year, which was something of a surprise. Who was that against? Tom Ford on his run to the semis. So, I mean, Joe O'Connor cannot be ruled out there. He's going to be very confident after that win over Maguire. He's a real tough, sort of grinding, steady opponent. Obviously, Higgins seen it all before, but I wouldn't be surprised if Joe picked up another win.
Neil Robertson's going straight off to Australia after the UK, and he's returning after nearly a month. And he's told me that he's been to Australia a fair bit, but he usually goes at the end of the season. And what he's going to enjoy about here, not just the fact it's summer and escaping, as he puts it, the dark, cold, wet days of the UK, but also a lot of his friends and family will be around. People tend to take time off at Christmas. So he's really seeing it as a reset. And he's saying again, Matt, that most people, the Chinese guys can to some extent, but not even they can really know what it's like to come from the other side of the world with your friends and family all there and compete over here. It's tough, and most of us can't understand unless we're there, can we?
Well, yes, I'm sure you're right. And particularly as even now, although we've had, you know, the great and positive influx of Chinese players, and we've had a few Canadian players and obviously a few Australians, still the majority are from the British Isles, and those who aren't are from Europe. So that's the case. So not only is he facing that challenge that you're talking about, but he's also one of the few who has to do it, really, you know, compared with the most that are from the British Isles. And it is a long way. It's as far as you can go. Of course, he's had his demons off the track. Off the track. That's me talking about Formula One again. off the table. I told you I was an F1 lifer. Anyway, off the table. Didn't he have an addiction to gaming, computer games at one
time? He did.
And that was, you know, he would suddenly not go to bed till 6 in the morning, and he had to get up at 8 for a tournament match.
Yeah.
But I think he's knocked that on the head now, has he not?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a while ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But again, you know, all fair play to anybody who faces those things down and comes out. I'm a big fan. You know, he's not allowed to have a Rolls-Royce Q action because only Sean Murphy can have one of them, but we'll give him a Bentley.
Very generous indeed. And we finish off with Robert Milkins against Tepchire Unnu. Tepchire has won all but one of their previous meetings and must, I guess, fancy his chances. Milkins has not quite hit the heights of the last sort of season or two, but did have a fine win over Mark Williams, which we should remember, had the champion of the champions last week. Let's just be honest, overall, what a tournament to look forward to. Terrific. Live on the BBC and Eurosport. It's going to be just one of the grand weeks. Big matches every afternoon, every evening. It's sort of thick and fast action, and it's got a little bit of that, you know, but some of the grandeur that was missing with this top 16 going straight there. A fine venue, big crowds expected. I understand ticket sales are terrific, so we're really, really looking forward to it. The UK Championship coming up. Matt, we're not going to be here too much longer, but we must ask you a little bit more about your life in F1. You've been a successful magazine editor. You've worked on the communications teams of F1 teams. You now got your own PR agency. I mean, it's just a combination of of jobs you've had, and that's a great testament to you that you can do all these different things and be a success in all of them.
Well, it's a great testament to being so old, actually, to be fair, because it means I've had time to do, I've had time to do all this stuff. I've been incredibly lucky. I have been and remain incredibly lucky in my life. I've had some great jobs. To work with Lewis Hamilton, which I did for 5 years at McLaren. And by the way, the first race I went to for McLaren in Melbourne, Australia, we won it. He won it. And then we won the championship at the end of that year. That was 2008. And we won the championship. And I was in the garage in Interlagos in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And he won it by overtaking Timo Glock's Toyota on the last corner, the last lap of the last race of the year. You could not make it up. You could not make it up. And, of course, sport does that. You know, that what I've just described, the 2008 champion Formula One championship showdown, is, you know, like the world's in 85, isn't it? It was 85, wasn't it? Steve Davis and Dennis Taylor.
It was. And, you know, my biggest F1 moment perhaps of all time, woke up in the middle of the night virtually to watch it. It was Mansell's tyre blowing in Adelaide. And look at that, Murray Walker. I've never seen a moment like that in that sport. That was my top one ever.
Do you know what Murray Walker actually said just before? He said, colossally, that's Mansell.
Yeah, colossally, that's Mansell. And then, of course, famously, wasn't it PK next in line, but he didn't win it either, and Prost won it, or vice versa, something like that.
I think we need a, you know, at some time in this tournament, I'm going to challenge, I'm hereby challenging one of the commentators, you know, I think it should be Neil Fools, should say, colossally, that's Bressel, or something like that.
Fantastic. Now, we're against the clock here a bit, and this is potentially an enormous question, but you've worked in sort of the PR side of F1 and sort of promotion and the media side. Is there anything that you think snooker could learn from a sport that's entirely different, but that does it very well, like Formula One?
Well, some people would think this is a strange thing to say, because you could say that how could the two sports be more different? You know, one of them is played at a sedate pace when you look at it, by, you know, men in suits with bow ties most of the time. And the other is cars going literally 230, 240 miles an hour with big shunts and ever-present danger. So how could you say they're similar? I think they're similar. One of the reasons I think I like them both is that they have similarities. First of all, absolute precision. You know, if you're braking for a corner at 180 miles an hour, and you know you have to turn in at 120 miles an hour, to shed those 60 miles an hour as quickly as possible, and then turn in without braking traction, without sliding, without understeering, without oversteering, and missing the wall by inches at that speed, and then getting the power down and doing it again and again. Precision, absolute precision. And of course, we know snooker is all about precision, all about, you know, obviously I'm talking mostly the cue ball, you know, keeping the cue ball under precise curation in that way. So I think that's the same. And then the other part is you're on your own. You're absolutely on your own. And, you know, in Formula One, it's harem scarum, and you don't have the time to think too much, although you'd be surprised how brilliantly some of the drivers are, and they will ask quite detailed questions on the car to pit radio at the same time as racing hell for leather. You just wonder how they've got the mind management or the mind space to do that, but they have, and we're talking about genius again. But they can't be anywhere lonelier. You know, if you're you know, 8-0 down against a player who's knocking in centuries, one visit victories all the time, and you're just sitting there. They can't be anywhere lonelier. You are all on your own. Or you miss a sitter, or you know you've got frame ball and you miss it and the other guy dishes up. There's nowhere more lonely than watching him, sitting on your chair, watching him dish up. And you knew, if only I hadn't missed that black off the spot, it was mine. So I think those things are very similar. If I wanted to talk about things that snooker could learn off Formula One. Now I'm going to make a slightly, have I got time for a slightly radical suggestion?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, well, you might not agree, and Jason Ferguson will probably send me a text saying, why the hell did you suggest that? But too late, hey. So what I actually think is remarkable about Formula One and has actually made Formula One more popular globally over the past 73 years, because that's how long it's been going at the Formula One World Championship, than perhaps it might have been otherwise, is that every tournament, race, Grand Prix, has exactly the same weighting, and you get the same number of points for winning it, whether it's Monaco or Azerbaijan. And there's a cumulative points total that goes forward, and the winner becomes world champion. And if you think about sports, there aren't actually that many sports where that is the case. Obviously, team sports there are, football, you know, you get points for a win and points for a draw. And at the end of the season, who scored more points is world is the series champion, the league champion. But that's what it's like in Formula One. And I wonder if there would be a possibility where you could have the ranking tournaments and you could give equal weighting, and then you could have a separate points total. I know there's a money list. Of course I know that. But I just wonder if there's something that could be around that. And you could have, I know there's a world championship, but you could have a, you know, a World Series victor or something like that. I don't know. I haven't gone and done the thought. I haven't, you know, nutted it out on the back of an envelope. And probably, you know, half your listeners will now be saying, will that guy go back to Formula One and leave us alone? But it's a pub conversation.
Well, let's throw it open to them, yeah?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying, because there's so much chat often about what needs to be done for the World Championship and things like that. Well, not things like that, that thing. But really, I think it's all about bringing up the importance and the level of the other tournaments rather than trying to improve the best one we've got. So, yeah, I mean, along those lines, as you say, it's something to talk about.
It's something to talk about over a pint or two, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very much so. Or in terms of this podcast, you can have your say over a pint or two if you want. TalkingSnooker at yahoo.com or tweet us at TalkingSnooker to what you've heard there from Matt. Matt, I also want to say, I talked to you about being a speaker at the top. You are a pretty forthright speaker on LGBTQ issues, and you are a founder and ambassador of Racing Pride, which was a movement developed with Stonewall to promote LGBTQ inclusivity in the motorsport industry. And of course, that's something you are passionate about. You are a, as I say, you know, you talk about those issues very openly, and I'm sure people are very grateful that you do so.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Some people say to me, why do we need it? This is 2023. You live in the UK. You live in London. You know, you're a gay man. You're married to another gay man. What have you got to worry about? And, you know, I understand that. But not everybody does live in London. Not everybody approaches their sexuality in the same way. And some people are closeted. Some people are nervous. Formula One and perhaps snooker too, for all I know, certainly football, will certainly have some closeted players. I'm not saying that any of the players we've mentioned, I think they're all heterosexual, and I think all the Formula One drivers, I believe, are heterosexual, current ones. But there have over the years been some gay guys that have been closeted. There's only been three that have ever come out, ever. I won't go into the history of who they are, but I could do if you wanted me to. Anyway, but I'm talking about the open ones. But anyway, what I actually think is that, you know, with Racing Pride, particularly it's now possible to come out if you are someone like me, a journalist, a PR comms person, a marketing person, a catering person, in those kind of areas within the teams. And don't forget, the teams have 750 or 800 employees altogether. But the biggest number of employees are mechanics and engineers, and it's hard for them to come out. There's something about the culture. You can come out if you're a journalist or you're a PR person, but you can't really come out if you're a mechanic, or it's harder. And I sometimes work, you know, Racing Pride, we actually work with three of the teams, Aston Martin, Alpine and Red Bull, but we also do occasional one-off work with Mercedes and Williams. So that's 5 out of 10 teams. We do a lot of work with them. And we go into the factories and we talk to the directors and the line managers about how to be more inclusive. And why do we do it? Because if you have, let's say, a 40-year-old mechanic who has been working for a team, let's say, for the sake of argument, it's Williams, for 17 years and has been closeted. And during those 17 years, he's gradually come out to his parents, to his brothers and sisters, to his neighbors. He's now got his boyfriend. Then he married his boyfriend and he's married to his boyfriend and he's out to his neighbors. But the only place he's not out at all is his place of work. And by the way, he works incredibly long, hard hours for that and travels to 24 Grand Prix and therefore lives with his teammates. But he has to, or feels he can't, share this secret. What you actually find is that that kind of double life isn't good for people. It's not good for the soul. It's not good for the psyche. And if you can help, as I try to, but never force or never urge, just say, I'm there to help if you want. And that's what we do at Racing Pride. If you would like to consider exploring a route via which you might come out, you might find it would be easier than you thought and less stressful and less horrible. And then you might be more relaxed. And I say, then my message to the teams is, those mechanics and engineers can make mistakes. They can make mistakes that can cost you victories, that can cost you valuable world championship points. And they're more likely to do that if they're distracted, and they're more likely to be distracted if they're unhappy. So if you can find a place where you can increase their well-being and their psychological well-being, they will make fewer mistakes. And you know what? Your cars will win more races. You will actually win more races if you evolve and curate a good LGBTQ plus and diversity, equity and inclusion policy. And when you start talking to them about you could win more races, then they go, oh, right, yeah, well, we're going to do that then. Because that's the competitiveness of professional sport, and Formula One is right up there. So that's what we do. And, you know, some people say it's not necessary, but hopefully my little explanation shows how it's valuable.
Well, it was a great explanation. We are most grateful for you making it, Matt. And I have to say, we'll say in a moment what just a brilliant guest you've been. But a quick word, Phil, about the Ronnie premiere on the green carpet. Ronnie Wood there from the Rolling Stones, of course, and as the aforementioned David Beckham, loads of players as well, Stephen Hendry, Judd Trump, Jack Lazowski. It was a top night out, wasn't it? Me and you in a suit, lesser seen.
Yeah, very rarely seen that, isn't it? Both at the same time, incredible stuff. Ian Wright and Alan Shearer as well. Buzz to see that. I was always a big fan of Ian Wright. It was really nice to see Judd and Jack there. I thought, obviously, Judd had a bit of a starring role at the end, but they didn't need to be there supporting. That was good to see. An amazing film. It's been near enough entirely positive reaction that I've seen from a couple of people I know who are not big snooker fans, really said the same as well. So it's created an encouraging amount of buzz. One thing I would say that I've seen on Twitter a bit, quite a number of fans from around the globe, and it's only available in the UK and Ireland, which is actually really disappointing. I don't know if that's going to change, because that, I mean, especially with Dave Beckham's reach in America, everywhere really, but especially America, you would think it's a really good chance to, you know, it's not WST behind it or anything, but so I don't know if Amazon care about the reach of snooker across the globe, but as a sport it would be nice if it is released everywhere, because you know, it would be a lot of people who aren't used to seeing any snooker could be introduced to it through that medium, so hopefully that'll change.
I thought it was a brilliant film. I thought it was, you know, heart-rendingly honest. I genuinely believe that Ronnie O'Sullivan was speaking from the heart throughout. You know, we saw him laugh and cry. I laughed and cried during the time watching it. And, you know, his mum and dad, obviously his dad's had a checkered time, let's put it that way, with his prison sentence. But both of them were, you know, it was interesting. Harrowing sometimes to hear them. You know, I'm not going to spoil it for those who haven't seen it, but do watch it. Absolute honesty and love, and from both mother and father, and of course from Ronnie in return. And a brilliant, 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 which I'm also not going to spoil. But, you know, we all know that Ronnie was mic'd up for the last two. He was mic'd up for the Masters and the Worlds. And at the end, when he managed to beat Judd Trump in the Worlds and they had that prolonged hug, of course, we couldn't really hear. Well, we couldn't at all hear when we were watching it live at the time. In the movie, you can hear everything. And all I will say is that that is human frailty in the raw, and human, that's from Ronnie, human frailty in the raw, and human nobility from Judd Trump in the raw, and unmissably brilliant end to the film in that sense.
Well, human frailty and human nobility, I think, is the best summing up I've heard of that amazing exchange. And Matt, you've been an outstanding guest. We're thankful to you. Please come back and see us again one day. Keep enjoying the snooker. And yeah, I hope everyone has enjoyed listening to you as much as we've enjoyed recording with you.
It's been an enormous privilege. And I know I'm a gatecrasher. I'm not really a snooker man like you are, but I love the sport. And I've been incredibly touched and am very grateful that you've given me the opportunity to spout on for an hour and a bit about it.
No, it's our pleasure entirely. And yeah, your love of it has come across, I'm sure everyone will agree. So yeah, well, I feel like we could have spoken to you for another hour. So we'll have to have you on again in the future, hopefully.
Only we could do coming up an hour and a half and still feel like we've got loads more to do, Phil. Typical talking snooker, very much on brand. Oh, well, we're heading off to enjoy the UK Championship. What a week coming up. And you out there, please, you know, do enjoy the tournament live in the UK on the BBC and Eurosport, and live in various other places through different broadcasters, which you can check on the WST website. So, yeah, this is one of the really special parts of the season, the first Triple Crown event. And please just relish it all from start to finish. We'll be back with you after the tournament to reflect on it all from York. But for now, from Matt, Phil and myself, cheerio.
Sports Social Podcast Network.